I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, a company that sells whole grain flours, cereals, and bread products to natural food stores across the United States. Bob started the company in 1978 after working as an auto mechanic owning gas stations for the first part of his professional life. When Bob turned 81 years old in 2010, he turned the company over to his over 200 employees through an ESOP, which is an employee stock ownership plan. The company is based in Portland, Oregon. I'm in New York City speaking to Bob, who's recording from Oregon Public Broadcasting. Welcome, Bob.
Well, thank you, Jessica. I'm very pleased to be here.
You grew up in Los Angeles, California in the 1930s. What did your parents do?
Well, my father actually in the 1930s was a Hostess cake and Wonder Bread dealer at the time. And then he went into a dressograph business with his father. They did extensive printing and mailing. One of the big accounts was MGM, Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, and I have fond memories of these publications that were sent out monthly to all the theaters in the United States and the world. I would go down and help them what we called stuff, which means that you took the magazine and put it in an envelope, and I got pretty fast at it.
So there was some entrepreneurial blood in your family to begin with, but there was also some baking blood, your father having worked for the Hostess Cupcake Company?
Yeah, it's kind of funny when I think back at what I'm in, because they really weren't very whole grain. And even in those days, my folks would kid about the, like a loaf of Wonder Bread, you could take it and stuff it into a little round ball. There wasn't much to it.
When did you first encounter whole grains?
Well, we had a dairy goat farm, and I know you have dairy goats, so we have a little something in common. But my wife ran across books by Adele Davis and Gaylord Houser. Rodell had his dictionary of health foods. Those were early kind of pioneers in whole grains and better way of life. Mm-hmm. And Charlie, my wife, began feeding us as a family. We have three boys. And with a little farm, she really piqued my interest in whole grains, baking bread, making great cookies out of whole wheat flour. And we discovered health food stores. There was two in Sacramento where we lived. Going into the health food stores and smelling the whole grains. And the whole thing was just kind of a neat experience, something I had not the slightest notion of before she introduced those things to me.
Now, a lot happened between Wonder Bread and Charlie, your wife, introducing you to these whole grains and you're discovering it together. So I want to step back a little bit. How did you meet your wife, Charlie?
I spent 3 years in the Army, and with the 3 years from the Army, I went to school in electrical engineering, and I worked at a company called U.S. Electrical Motors. And Charlie, my wife, was one of the day workers, and because her name was Charlie, C-H-A-R-L-E-E, they all called her Chuck. And there's always a certain curiosity, you know, especially when you're single. Well, I wonder what a girl named Chuck looks like. Well, we courted for a while and got married, and we've had a wonderful marriage. If I had it to do over, I'd do exactly the same thing again.
Oh, you mentioned that you and Charlie worked at the U.S. Electrical Motors in the 1950s. What did you do specifically for them?
They sent me out traveling, doing work in the field. My job was to troubleshoot and try to correct things. So it was a pretty responsible job, but it also required me to travel a lot. And we were having children at this time. And all in all, after about 5 years, I just simply felt that I didn't want to keep doing this. And one other thing I might say, Jessica, was my father passed away, and he and I were so close. He was a heavy smoker. I haven't got a whole lot of use for tobacco, and partly because I lost my dad at 49. So it inspired me to want to go into business because Dad and I had always talked about going into something together. But when he passed away, it just really shocked me that I lost this wonderful friend.
So upon your father's passing away, you actually had a first foray into an entrepreneurial life where you bought a service station, a mobile station that was for sale.
It was a brand new mobile station, and I guess I think the way I got started was there was a sign on the property, coming soon, a brand new mobile station, and then a phone number about the need for dealers, and I made a phone call, and I don't know, Jessica. That's been a long time ago. I was about 25, and things went pretty fast. We put our GI home up for sale and sold it right away and got enough money to satisfy the mobile company that I could have this gas station. The joy of being in business for yourself, even though I worked, like the first year I worked 365 days. I opened every morning, closed every night. Mm-hmm. So I got a taste of hard work and staying with things. And Charlie, bless her heart, she stayed right with me, helped me with certain things, paperwork and stuff. And we had three boys by that time.
You capitalized the gas station with the returns from selling your house for $4,500.
That's about right.
How successful was the mobile station that you ran in L.A.?
Very comfortably successful. But I have to tell you that living in Los Angeles, which is where all this happened, and with the boys and all, we kept – there was an underlying unhappiness about Los Angeles. The smog in the 50s was really something. And it just kind of bugged us. So we spent a little time looking about – since I had a gas station, and I thought, well, heck, I can make a living anywhere with a gas station, wherever there is one. So we sold the station, and we sold our nice home and moved up to Mammoth Lakes, California, and we moved into a trailer, mobile home, I guess we called them, with the family and all. It's an interesting change in life. The whole year of 1960, was a very strange weather year, and the gas station business just was not good. And I just proceeded over a period of 12 months to expend all the money I had. And unfortunately, I went broke.
What did you think about doing? You went broke. You had three children. What was your mental state at the time?
I have a pretty good mental state, period, even today. And what I actually did was I drove down to Sacramento, California, and I got a job at the dealer of U.S. Electrical Motors. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a matter of getting back on our feet again. So we moved the trailer to Sacramento, and I wasn't in business for myself anymore. I was working for somebody else.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, a company that produces whole grain products, including cornmeal, barley, and whole wheat flour. Bob started the company in 1978. Along the way, you discovered a book called John Goffey's Mill by George Woodberry, which is a book about milling in the 1700s. How did that pique your interest?
It's an autobiography of a portion of his life. He inherited this mill, John Goffey's mill, in Bedford, New Hampshire. And the mill was a derelict. He went to the mill to discover what he had. And this whole book is about his life and his experiences restoring the mill. It was water-powered, stone mill, grinding corn, grinding wheat. And actually, the story that he tells was so wonderful the historical aspects of it and having people come, and the successfulness of it was another thing. That I'm an entrepreneur. I like to think that way, and he obviously was too. But it was the historicity of the whole thing. I mean, he was dealing with millstones that were a couple hundred years old. The book was written about 1950. So it wasn't all that old when I picked it up. And I was just, I think, maybe the only person in the world that was just so fascinated with a book that it basically had to change my life.
Mm. Now, at what point did you discover the book?
When we moved to Sacramento after we went broke up in the mountains, we were able to get this dairy goat farm. Mm. And during that time, my wife got us interested in whole grains. And it was later when we actually moved to Redding, California, and it was there that this book, John Goffey's Mill, was in the library. And I just picked it up. It actually was set there on the library table. Someone hadn't put it away. So I've always felt kind of a providential sense about this, because that book is really the fundamental change in my life. It gave me purpose. Mm-hmm. First off, George Woodbury didn't know anything about milling, mm-hmm. but he took on this because he owned it and he was successful. And I thought, you know, if he can do this, I can do it.
There's connective tissue between the auto engineering and the engineering behind grinding technologies, but I feel like that's kind of where the similarities stop, because in a way you were dealing with cars and things that were very much man-made and industrial on the one hand, but here this milling of things from the earth was kind of on the opposite end of the spectrum, using soils and the natural life to produce things. Did that at all occur to you at the time?
Yes. Making your living with whole grains, which are as close to the earth as you can get, has a great appeal to me. And it's totally opposite the automotive end of things, the mechanics and everything else. And I guess really the automobile today, unless we turn to electricity, is still kind of a polluter of everything. It is a polluter of everything. And I felt very strongly about the health aspects of whole grains. And yeah, it was a change for me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods. We'll hear more from Bob coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill Natural Foods, a company that sells whole grain flours, cereals, and bread products to natural food stores across the United States. Bob started the company in 1978 after working as an auto mechanic owning gas stations for the first part of his professional life. When Bob turned 81 years old in 2010, he turned the company over to his over 200 employees through an ESOP, which is an employee stock ownership plan. I'm in New York City speaking with Bob, who is in Portland, Oregon. Upon reading the book, you decided to start a company with your three children in California. It was sort of the predecessor for the current company. Can you talk a little bit about that experience?
Sure. I think right as soon as I finished John Goffey's Mill, I took, still in the library, books on American manufacturing. I looked up flour milling, grinding, all kinds of things. And I wrote a bunch of letters to the companies in the United States that I thought could help me get some equipment. And I got a response from just one. And he put me in touch with an old gentleman that had a mill. And things just began to take shape. His name was Dewey Sheets, a charming old gentleman. Dewey told me about a mill in Fayetteville, North Carolina, that had all the stone grinding equipment in it and stuff that he thought I would need. Through Dewey, I was able to get several stone mills. in bucket elevators and grain cleaners and different things that would be necessary to go into this new idea and new way of life for us. The boys were just wonderful helping to get all this going. I was kind of the driving force, but they read the books. I can't really believe how well we did. It was very successful. The media came out, TV people or newspaper, this crazy little business, and we had it set up so that people could look through a large window at these stone mills that we had acquired, and we would grind custom cornmeal, barley, whole wheat flour, all kinds of the whole grains, and we were learning. Our customer base was Redding, California, about 18,000 people. So, you know, there was definite limitations to what our little company could do in Redding because of the small population.
Yet despite this success, you decide to move to Oregon and go to seminary and learn the Bible. What was the process behind, you know, leaving this business and saying to your wife and kids, you know what, I want to move to Portland and learn the Bible, and not just learn the Bible in English, but learn it in Hebrew and Greek?
Well, I've had wonderful religious experiences in my life, and I am a Christian. I have great respect for the Bible and felt that I wanted to learn more about it. And Portland has about four seminaries, and so we came up here on a little vacation and inquired as to whether we could take courses, and I was successful. The Western Evangelical Seminary, which is now not here, but they were willing to take Charlie and I on with these courses. They had some great scholars there. So we sold the house. The business I just more or less gave to the boys, and then we moved on to Portland, Oregon.
It seems like your life has been, you know, quite nomadic and very much filled with exploration and adventure to some degree. Whereas, in contrast, you know, people's lives tends to have, at least these days, a stickiness to it. How you could just, you know, pick up and go from California to Oregon and leave the milling business that you had started with your children to then you just go to seminary.
Well, I think you're causing me to think about myself here a little bit, Jessica. The nomadic thing, I guess. I guess I was a little nomadic. Everything seemed to have a good purpose to it. I'm reviewing in my mind. Here, my wife and I, our children are grown, and we've always gotten along very well. And I thought it'd be kind of cool moving up to Portland, just the two of us. It was like a honeymoon in a way. I mean, I thought it was time to let the boys figure things out for themselves. They're still in the business. So when we moved to Portland here, we enjoyed it. I think of the first 6 months, 8 months of being in Portland and going to school was one of the most wonderful times of our life.
And then in 1978, while you're at seminary, you decided to start a chapter two of your life, which was then to build Bob's Red Mill. How did that happen? What was the turning point for that?
Well, we were in school, and we did a ton of walking. Walking with vocabulary cards, Greek nouns and verbs and things, and trying to memorize them so we could learn the language and whatnot. And after we'd been here for several months, we walked down a certain street, and here was an old flour mill. I could not believe my eyes. So I walked over and looked in, and I can still remember my wife saying, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "Well, I just want to look at it." But, you know, there was a phone number, and it was vacant. And I said, "Well, I'm just going to call." She said, "Well, you know, I thought we were going to go to school." Well, we were. And I said, "Well, just let me just make a phone call." And but it just kind of boiled down to the property was available. It had a lot of the equipment that I needed to start another mill. It had bucket elevators and different things. And guess what? I got a hold of Dewey Sheets, my original mentor, and he had a mill that he could get for me. And the thing went together so rapidly that it was almost like a dream.
And you mentioned before a providential sense when you found the John Goff's Mill book in the library. To what extent did you think Providence played a role in your finding this mill by happenstance in Portland?
Well, I have to say, that's my take on it, Jessica. I have this sense of walking in a glow of some kind, and it seems to play a part in my life. I think I have been guided by these things, and the way they happened is so unusual. The old mill, the reason the mill quit working, there used to be a rail line alongside of it, and they tore the rail line out in 1957. So the building was really just derelict, but we brought our grains in by truck. But the original owners, I guess, thought that the rail was the only way to do it.
You've had a charmed life to some extent. You just walk into this mill and you find the proper equipment and everything just works beautifully. And one of your allies in this whole process is the media in Oregon. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
I don't think we'd been open 2 weeks when, Kathy Smith. She was a news person on our local ABC, and she was out with a camera. I couldn't believe it. And, you know, after that went on the evening news, people just flocked to the mill. It was just astounding. I have to say that the media in Portland was just unbelievably good to Bob's Red Mill, Jessica. We had several programs that like to come out, television programs, and they just love to come out and start their show from this old mill. In our local newspapers, the Oregonian, of course, just on a steady, regular basis, I have had the most wonderful response from the media, and I don't know what I could have done without them. It was incredible.
And when you were thinking about launching the business and thinking about all the logistics involved, how much did you think about, PR and the role that media is going to play in my success?
I don't think I thought of anything about that. I just thought the mill was clever enough. If you see any pictures of it, it was we eventually painted it red. In the very beginning, it was so unique, and I'm a great believer in advertising. I put small ads in the Oregonian and in our local newspaper. So I actually helped myself to some degree make it work. I didn't just sit back and kind of helpless about the whole thing. But the kind of advertising that I put in the paper, advertising my whole grain flour, whole wheat cornmeal, things like that, those were successful ads. But I don't think anything was as near as successful. When the evening news had this little thing on the entrepreneurials of Portland.
Incidentally, we talk about how successful the business was really at the inception, in part because the media was so friendly to you. What were some of the challenges that you faced in the early days?
Challenges. Let's see. Well, I don't know, Jessica, whether I really look back on that era of times, about 10 years that we had the mill before our disastrous arson fire burned it to the ground. But taking into consideration the 10 years from 1978 to 1988, those were some of the best years of my life. I guess the real challenge was trying to keep up with business. I think even today my challenge is the growth of the company.
You started a retail operation initially in Oregon with roughly 7 employees. What then was responsible for the business becoming a wholesale business and jumping to eventually 200-plus employees?
Actually, some of the local grocery chains, well, Safeway is not local, but their local warehouses and stuff wanted some of our products. They wanted to carry whole grain products. And the biggest was Fred Meyer. They were a local company that had stores in the Northwest. They had about 44 stores, and they were opening nutrition centers, health food stores, if you will, as a part of their grocery stores. That was about 1978, just about the time I started. Those people came to me and they wanted my products, and I laughed at them. My retail business was pretty good, and my wife and I were not having any problem making our bills. We had, I'm going to guess about 7 people by that time. And I finally decided that I would give it a try. So across the street from where the mill was a vacant building. It was about 20,000 square feet. Mm-hmm. And we rented that for warehouse and other needs that we had, and began the process, adding people, the challenge of new packaging, new lines, everything.
So how did you go about funding the business?
Well, I had a great rapport with U.S. Bank. Bruce Cullison was the bank manager of the local U.S. Bank in Oregon City. And Bruce and I, he just really believed in what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And back in the 70s, bank managers had a lot more autonomy with their loans and different things. And Bruce really believed in what I was doing. He and his wife would come to the mill and buy things. And so he made it pretty easy for me to borrow money. Let's say borrowing money at that time would be like $50,000.
By the way, who supplied you with all this cornmeal and barley and whole wheat flour, et cetera?
Well, I think that we've created like corn and wheat. Those particular grains, we are still dealing with the same people we were dealing with when we first started in Davis, California. There's a large 6,000 acre farm there. The Gill, we call them the Gill boys, father and son actually, and we're still buying our corn from them even after 30, almost 40 years.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill, a company that produces whole grain products, including cornmeal, barley, and whole wheat flour. In 1988, the mill was destroyed one night by a fire by a woman who set fire to the mill. Was there any thought in your mind that, you know what, this is a sign that I'm finished after 10 years of this solid growth? Or did you just say, you know what, I'm going to pick up where I left off and start over?
You're just numb by the whole thing. I mean, you're called at 12:30 at night, and I was only a mile and a half from the mill. And as soon as I got my car out of the garage and started down the street, I could hear sirens. And when I turned the corner, I could see the glow. So in the horizon, that I was pretty aware of what it was. And those kind of feelings you have are they're kind of numbing. A few minutes later, my wife came down, and even one of the firemen, the volunteer fireman, was an employee of my company. So, you know, we were kind of a community effort here. By that time, we had 20 or 22 employees. One of my oldest employee, who is still with me today, he and his wife had just signed the papers for a new home that morning. And, of course, there were other people that had depended on me, had been working for me for 10 years. So there's a certain responsibility that you feel when these people have dedicated their lives to the same cause that you're dedicated to. There was a certain reality, too, and that is that everything that I had financially was tied up in the business. Plus, I got my insurance check from the insurance company. I took it to the bank, to Bruce Cullison, my dear banker, and he said, "Do you want me to deposit this in your bank account?" And I said, "Well, Bruce, that's your money, because after all, we have the loan." And he said, well, you're going to stay in business, aren't you? And all my people stuck with me. Fred Meyer, at that time my biggest customer, although we had Safeway and Albertsons and different others, they were good enough to put signs up in the sections where our product was about the mill. The product would be slow coming. We had that 20,000 square feet across the street. We moved into that as tight as we could. And here's my son Bob in Redding, California. One of my millers moved down with Bob for 3 months, and Dean would work all night milling stuff for us, and then be ready for Bob to take over and mill stuff for himself during the day. There just seemed to be so many people that were rooting for us. Within about 3 months, we found a 50,000 square foot location, just a couple of miles from the mill. All of these different circumstances, I was almost 60, so, how many people would hire me? I gave it some thought.
By the way, I'm sitting here in New York and you're in Oregon, and while you're in your 80s, you sound like you're in your 30s. how do you stay so healthy and sharp?
Well, now you're going to expect me to say I eat whole grains every day. and Jessica, I do eat whole grains. My wife's a great cook, and we've made whole grains a basic part of our life. You know, I'm very active, very, very active. I walk a lot. My cholesterol is 121. I eat flaxseed meal. I have oatmeal for breakfast, and I'm reasonably careful.
But Bob, you can't hide the fact that you did have your share of Hostess baked items when you were a child.
I think so. Yes, I did. Yeah.
Well, Bob, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, you bet, Jessica.
My guest has been Bob Moore, founder of Bob's Red Mill.
Coming up, we'll meet Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Brownie. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Bakery, a company that sells brownies and other sweet treats, my pretty. They ship their brownies across the country and have a retail shop in Chelsea Market in Manhattan. Welcome.
Thank you, Jessica.
You were a trader on the American Stock Exchange prior to starting Fat Witch. How did you decide to switch jobs and start a brownie bakery?
I really wanted to do something on my own. I don't think I can pinpoint it exactly, except that sort of building feeling that one has of, I want more satisfaction out of my career. And based on that, I also went through some personal tragedy, and I thought, you only have one life. Go do what you want to do.
Mm-hmm. How long were you working on the stock exchange?
Over 10 years.
Were you baking brownies for your colleagues, or were brownies in the picture at all?
They certainly were. I was baking for colleagues and bringing them in. And that's where the germ of the seed of the idea came for the business. Because people would say, those brownies you bake? I want to buy some. I'm having a party.
And where did you get the recipe from?
It was my mother's recipe.
How did you come to that decision ultimately to actually go through the process of leaving work and starting this bakery?
I was baking with somebody whose father had a bagel factory. And so we would use the bagel ovens, which are very different than a regular convection oven because they are almost like a Ferris wheel. They turn around and around. But we did a huge order for Goldman Sachs for Christmas 1 year, for the holiday season 1 year. And then I thought, this is a go.
And how did you get Goldman Sachs as a customer that year?
Because I knew some people from Goldman.
Where did you go from there?
I sent out 8 postcards to friends. I drew them and sent them out and said, I'm selling brownies. And that 8 postcards. And I can't, what I did do is keep diligent lists and, get it on a computer, get it into a database, and very every single person who we sent to, and it's now probably a quarter of a million database people.
How did you come up with the witch theme?
I had a from trading, and as you might know, trading floors, one stands very close to someone else, and it's a lot of bumping and this and that. And I had a friend who had a laugh like just like a witch. And one day she said, "Oh, I'm pregnant." And I said, "Oh, now I'll be standing next to a fat witch." And I just thought it was a funny name. I put it on the brownies. And we're not going to lie. They are fattening. We do use butter.
Part of the success to me in Fat Witch is the packaging and the whimsical artwork. Did you draw the logo?
Yes, I did. Packaging for anything, even if it's a consulting business, is very important. And I wanted each brownie to be the sense of you're getting a gift within a gift. And because most of our mothers bake brownies, I wanted something childlike in the drawing, in the logo.
Has the witch in the logo come alive to you? Like, do you look at her as kind of personified, or is it just, you know, this inhuman piece of art?
Oh, absolutely come alive. I mean, sometimes when I see 500 brownies lined up, it's almost like each one is moving, or, you know, they're a little bit different.
From 91 to 98, you were only known to Goldman Sachs and to your friends and family. Were you making enough to sustain yourself? Was this business break even at this point, or profitable?
It was barely break even. You know, I had some savings, and that's what I was using.
How much capital did you put into the business personally when you were starting?
Personally, about $25,000.
And how long did it take to finally reach some type of profitability where, okay, yeah, I could make a living doing this?
It probably took about 6 or 7 years. But, I mean, you know, I was getting some income. So it wasn't a money losing, but we weren't really, you know, we were barely eking by. I mean, when I first started, I thought, if I could just get an order every day, it would be so amazing. Then it would be okay. We'll go forward. And that was like one order every day of the month.
How much was one order?
You know, it'd be like $30 or something.
And how much would it cost you to make that order and package it and sell it?
Well, you know, about $10.
So you're making $20 a day and you'd be happy.
Well, it wasn't a matter of being happy. I thought we could survive. We can build on this.
And do you have any children or anybody else to support financially?
No, I don't.
Was there any bank loan or anything in the process?
No. I mean, and you know, interesting that you bring it up, because when we were building out, one of the things we couldn't get was a bank loan. So without debt, you can't prove that you can take on debt.
What would banks say to you?
No, you know, you can't prove that you can grow. If your business has some debt and you have a track record of paying it back, you're actually in better shape than having no track record.
Were there times when you were thinking of leaving the business or doing something new?
Oddly enough, no. I mean, there were low moments, certainly, but I was determined to make this work.
When you say there were low moments, what do you mean by that?
I would say the lowest moment, you know, mentally, was a rainy day in Manhattan. And to back up a little, we used to hand deliver things to businesses. And our delivery person did not show up. So in this pouring, pouring rain, I said, well, I'm going to have to go do this. And I had put on an old pair of running shoes that were just half falling apart. Get to the place, drop it off. Blessedly, I didn't know anybody from this firm. You know, it's a Wall Street firm. I thought, if I bump into someone, die. But I didn't. Dropped it off. And as I was walking out, the sole of my shoe fell off. You know, I thought, this is just a low moment. Why am I doing this?
Now, I would think that it's kind of an isolating process. Did you miss any kind of socialization? Because you went from the floor of the American Stock Exchange, where you were in this throng of traders every day, and then you're just you.
That's a really good question. You know, yes, there was moments of feeling alone and alone on decision making. But I think I was always meeting people. and always interacting with people that I didn't feel the pinch of where I think someone who's doing a consulting business at home, you know, might say, I just got to get out and go to a coffee shop so I can see other people. I never had that.
And then in 1998, you found your retail space in Chelsea Market. How did you go about finding that spot? Because Chelsea Market is kind of this popular location in New York City where there are a lot of artisanal bakeries selling their brownies or their cookies or their wine or their fresh vegetables and produce. How did you come to land in that spot?
I happened to walk by it. I had been doing a lot of work, and literally walking and pounding the pavement, trying to find space. I came across it, and I thought, this is it. And I begged.
I begged,
because they didn't have space at the time. And I said, when the next space that opens up, let me move in.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Pat Helding, founder of Fat Witch Bakery, a mail-order company that bakes and ships brownies called Witches across the country. Pat also sells a book on her website called Hannah's Homework, an entrepreneurial story for little women. Were there any lucky moments in the early days that helped accelerate the business?
One thing we've always been lucky with is publicity. I have a whole file drawer of all the publicity we've gotten. So we're always sending out media kits and building on. So I think the lucky moments are getting on, you know, Oprah's Best Things list and CNN, and of course, this radio show would be the top.
Oh, so charming, Pat. I've heard that Japanese tourists love Fat Witch Bakery. I've heard stories that there are busloads of Japanese tourists who come and take pictures and buy Fat Witch brownies. Is that true?
Yes, it is. We have up in the bakery in Chelsea a sign in Japanese characters with a witch in a kimono.
And how did they come to know about Fat Witch Bakery?
This I don't have the answer for, but they come in droves. I mean, I know why they keep coming, and it's word of mouth, and we do get in a lot of Japanese publications and have been on Japanese TV. It's packaged very much in a way that the Japanese can understand. It's a little package, and our Fat Witch babies are the size that they're used to. It's a small thing.
And how about the taste of the brownies for Japanese people? I mean, I know in some Asian cultures, sweets are not as popular as they are in the United States. How does their palate react to respond to the brownies?
And in terms of the taste, chocolate is certainly a new thing to Asia, but making huge headways. In Japan, there is something called obligatory chocolate, where people give each other chocolate. I do fear that on shelves everywhere in Japan are little Fat Witch brownies, you know, just sitting there, and that people haven't eaten them because they've bought them for the packaging and the logo.
So they keep it on maybe their fireplace mantle in their living room as a piece of art, maybe.
Maybe.
Your brownies are wrapped like little presents. You know, you have them perfectly folded and with the sticker on top. Are those done by hand?
Right now, they're done by hand. What I found very hard, personally, was trying to become more automatic and having engineers. It took me 4 years to find one. And I was not going to give up. I was not going to wrap these brownies the way everybody else did. In a sleeve, you know, everyone said, oh, no, that's the only way you can do it. And I said, but we're doing it by hand with a diamond fold because it looks like a gift. And I thought, I want to meet my grandfather, who was a mechanical engineer back in, you know, the 1880s, 1900, 1910. When I met a man from Romania who's an American citizen, you know, now he works, does all kinds of stuff for big companies. And he took us on. And we have in Harlem, we'll have a computerized cutting thing.
You are now building an 8,000 square foot facility in Harlem in New York City. How come?
We need more production space. We turn down business all the time. We have a waiting list of wholesale clients that want us.
And why in Harlem? I would think that Manhattan is more expensive than going to some of the outer boroughs like Queens or the Bronx. How did you happen upon this space in Harlem?
Certainly the city wants all manufacturing to be in the South Bronx and Long Island City. This was sheer luck to some degree. You know, I say it was luck, but the reality is I really pounded the pavement, you know, looking at lots. And this is a happened to be someone putting up a building that needed light manufacturing, and we happened to walk in at the right moment.
You sell a book on your website called Hannah's Homework, which is a book for little women to teach them about entrepreneurship. And the book is done in the style of a composition notebook that some of us remember when we were younger. It doesn't have the black marble on the cover, but it does have sort of that canvas linen material going down the spine on the side. How did you come to write this book?
I wrote it because I feel passionate that we need to be encouraging people, and especially girls, about the possibilities of having an option of being an entrepreneur and being in business and being in business for yourself. And that there's a great deal of satisfaction that one can have of creating your own business.
The central theme of the book is there's this witch named Hannah who is in elementary school, and she doesn't want to do her homework. She wants things to come more easily for her. The book's message is, no, it requires a lot of hard work and no shortcuts. Do you
exactly. You just nailed it.
Do you feel that you had any shortcuts in your work, in your experience opening this bakery?
I think all of this
an autobiography?
No, it's not an autobiography. I certainly like to draw, you know, Hannah's passion is drawing and doing artwork. And she, like many people, not just kids, think, oh, you just get lucky when you have a business, or I'll just get lucky on this homework assignment. And it rarely happens. It's usually doing the work and the research to build a foundation.
I love there's a cat named Patience who sleeps on the gargoyle outside the window. Where'd you come up with the name Patience for the cat?
There's a lot of words in the book that are words, they're clues, they're thoughts that you need when you're running a business, and patience is one of them.
On your website, fatwitch.com, you have vintage photos by H.W. Helding. Who is H.W. Helding?
Was my father, and part of my inheritance was just boxes and boxes of photographs that he had taken from when he was young all through his life.
They are beautiful photographs. Have you done anything with those photographs commercially?
No, I haven't. I've had people ask to buy them. And then he, when he was young, I think his first camera, he happened to be in New York and, you know, took some of these pictures from just a different era. It's just a wide variety, mainly of people.
Strangers?
Yeah.
And there's a sense of nostalgia about those photos, and certainly, you know, brownies have a sense of nostalgia as well.
Absolutely. And I wanted to connect. Wanted those photographs that are on the website are of New York City. And so I want to establish that we're a New York brownie. I think New Yorkers are pretty sophisticated. And if we can make it here, we can make it anywhere. So using those photographs was a sort of a throwback to both things, nostalgia and New York.
Speaking of nostalgia, do you remember ever being in your mother's kitchen while she was baking, whether it was the brownies or cooking some dinner?
Absolutely. All the time. It's a very fond memory of, you know, something warm coming out of the oven. Mm-hmm. Chocolate chip cookies. My mother made a great chocolate chip cookie, which I have to redo the recipe at some point with Fat Witch Bakery, because she would put, being Danish, she would put coffee in the cookies. And I mean, when my mother died, people were calling me for about a year saying, you know, what made your mother's cookies so good? I said, the coffee.
Now, your brownies have 30% more chocolate than other traditional brownies.
Absolutely.
Deeper chocolates?
Yeah, we use a 71% bittersweet chocolate, which is a pretty high chocolate content. I think it's almost as high as you can go. Chocolate without sugar is almost impossible to eat.
It becomes homework.
Right. There you go.
You've been doing this for so many years, since 1991. Do you still have those initial satisfying moments?
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that's incredibly satisfying is when people walk in the bakery in Chelsea Market and they ask for witches, they're not asking for brownies. And I kind of step back and I say, and somebody, I hear someone, I'll take 3 caramel witches and 2 walnut witches. And I say to myself, I made this up, you know. And it's just, it's a thrill. I would say most people are very generous with their praise and their thoughts. And it's a pleasure.
I think the public is also gracious and in a good mood when, because they're buying brownies. They're not buying insurance.
That could be. It's about a quality product with a sense of humor.
How many brownies are you baking per day?
At least 1,000 per day, usually around 2,000, and busy seasons, you know, 10 to 20,000.
What do you think of the Duncan Hines or Betty Crocker brownies that are sold in supermarkets?
I think it's a solution. You know, if you've got a bake sale, that's certainly a solution.
Do you like the taste of those?
No, because they're filled with chemicals.
I love
lots
them.
Okay. Would you serve it as a dessert at a dinner party?
Well, now that you're making me feel guilty, I probably wouldn't.
Okay, good.
Well, thank you very much, my pretty, for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Pat Helding, the founder of Fat Witch Bakery. To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.